Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. In each episode of these podcasts, we examine a key theme driving our world. With access to the world's leading experts, we explore the past, present, and future. Hello, I'm Adam Bolton. Today we're going to talk about the integrated circuit, better known as the chip. There are many inventions and discoveries that have changed the way we live, from the wheel to the light bulb to the combustion engine to penicillin, an equivalent being in recent times the so-called chip, or more correctly, the silicon chip integrated circuit. Originally resulting from post-Second World War research into integrated circuits, its development 70 years on, and still within the lifetime of a significant number of people, has reached into almost every aspect of our lives. So how did it happen? How did one thing lead to another? I spoke first to Thomas Haig from the University of Wisconsin, the author of A History of Modern Computing. And I asked him, first of all, where chips fit in with computing.
Well, the chips come along in the 1960s and building blocks for digital electronics. But there have been programmable digital computers since the 1940s. And today we just tend to talk about computers. But at the time, the kind of computers that we're familiar with now were always called digital computers. And that emphasized something very important about the way that they worked.
Right. What is a digital computer then?
Literally, it would be something that represents digits internally. So the digital approach existed before programmable computers in the 40s, although it wasn't called that at the time, in things like mechanical adding machines. And in those, you would have a cog that had 10 different positions to represent the possible values of a single digit. In an adding machine, you increment it as you increase the total that's being stored. Eventually, it winds all the way around back to zero, and it carries one to the next position with a little mechanical arm that will push the next cog around one further position. And digital computers basically worked the same way, but they could carry out a sequence of operations automatically, what we'd call a program. And they needed different technologies to represent that. In the 30s and 40s, people started to build programmable electronic computers using relay switches, which are little physical switches that have a magnet inside, and the magnet triggers a little piece of metal to go backwards and forwards between two possible positions. That was used in switching telephone systems, but they realized that also those could be useful in representing numbers inside automatic computers.
So when we move from cogs to chips, what did that mean for computing?
Well, the chip is basically able to do electronically the same thing that the relay switch can do in terms of switching back between having elements inside it that can switch back and forth between two possible positions, allowing it to represent binary digits. But electronics can do that a whole lot faster. The first electronic computers used vacuum tubes. And if any of your listeners are familiar with very old radios or televisions, or with extremely high-end niche hi-fi gear, those were built around vacuum tubes.
Yeah, valves.
Or valves, as they're called in England. And those are essentially using the same technology as old school incandescent light bulbs. There's a glass envelope, there's components inside it, but instead of just being about burning up electrical current to make light, they're about carrying out electronic processes. For example, amplifying a signal is crucial to all kinds of audio equipment.
And so basically the jump to, I guess that early on they weren't called chips so much, were they? They were called semiconductors. I mean, that jump just increased the potential power of a computer.
Yes. So to clarify that slightly, the valves stroke vacuum tubes were electronic and could work much faster than mechanical things like cogs or relay switches. But they were bulky, they burned up a lot of electricity, they made a lot of heat. Just like light bulbs, they tended to burn out. So computers were big, expensive, hot The technology that comes along before the chip, but is also a semiconductor, is the transistor. So in a way, a chip is just another way of packaging transistors. And transistors were invented at Bell Labs in the US, and they started to be produced and incorporated into devices in the 1950s. So I mentioned that one of the most popular uses for a vacuum tube was amplifying. And a transistor could do the same job in a much smaller package, which was more robust and required less power. So that's where semiconductor comes in. Transistors were built out of silicon or germanium, which are semiconducting materials.
And at this stage, the technology was, as you say, Bell Labs. So that was American technology fundamentally.
Yeah, and there's also a story about a European invention of the transistor at about the same time. But in these cases, it's not so much important what's the first as the way in which the devices get manufactured and commercialized. And the US at that point was able to do it on a much larger scale than Europe was. So transistors go mainstream first, for example, in transistor radios, right? Before the Walkman in the 80s, the first portable music source was a little battery-powered radio that you could walk around with. And that was possible because of the shift from the vacuum tubes / valves to transistors. For an amplifier, I think you basically only need one transistor in the minimal case. But if you take two transistors and put them together, you can make a switch that works in the same way as the mechanical relay switch. It can be stable in one of two positions, but it's much, much faster to shift because instead of a mechanical arm going backwards and forwards, which is always going to take a certain amount of time, you can have electrons moving and they can move much, much quicker.
And when, obviously, we've talked about audio technology, transistors and all the rest of it, when was the sort of big leap forward in terms of computing and computer power?
Well, computer power has increased steadily and rapidly, but without anything you can point to and say, this is the single great leap. But behind the surface, to maintain that steady advance, there have been enormous investments in different technology, changes in computer architecture, etc. Computers began to transistorize in the late 1950s, and by the early 1960s, they were pretty much all built using transistors. But at this point, they're still discrete components. And what that means, I know if your listeners can visualize, say, what the circuit board of a radio or another consumer electronic device from the 70s would look like, is you've got a circuit board with a bunch of little packages. The transistors are round little things with three legs. You've also got capacitors and diodes. The diodes have got little colored stripes on. The capacitors are a little bit sausage-like and also have two connectors. And that's basically the same kind of transistor technology that computers would have built within the 60s. So the chip comes essentially as a new way of miniaturizing and packaging those transistors and other electronics.
So what? A sort of all-in-one circuit board, almost.
So the circuit board, you may have heard those called printed circuit boards, or PCB. And in many ways, the printing of circuit boards is the same approach that was later used internally with chips. So the circuit board is a plastic base, and it's got little, very flat, foil-like strips of wire, well, strips of metal, which connect together the various components that are on it. And a technique devised during World War II and commercialized in the decade after that for printing circuit boards would cover the top of the circuit board, the entire thing, with a thin layer of metal, and then use a mask to mark out the places where the connections needed to be, and then a chemical wash to remove the metal from all the parts that weren't masked, right? Same kind of way you might use masking tape where you're painting, and then you remove it, and there's an area there that isn't painted. So the metal would be removed everywhere except where the connections, known as traces, were needed on the circuit board. And that made it possible to produce complicated circuit boards quickly and efficiently. So the idea with the chip basically is, instead of having a whole bunch of separate transistors, capacitors, and resistors, all of them made out of a semiconducting material like silicon, let's have one block of silicon and mark out the different components inside it. And that basically needs a similar kind of process. So the design for the chip would actually be produced on a large piece of paper and then miniaturized photographically, because the chip itself is small, right? That conventionally we talked of as being maybe the size of a small fingernail. And on that initially, right, I mean, we're used to thinking of chips with millions and millions of components on. The first chips, which were produced in the 1950s, would have only a handful of components on. Chips are described often in terms of the processes that make them. And they talk about the processes in terms of a size of the smallest, it's called the minimum feature size, the smallest size of a component that can be etched onto the chip. In the early days, the late 1960s, that would be about 1/50th of a millimeter, 20 micrometers. And that's like the width of a thin human hair. So that's certainly tiny, but it's also more or less visible, right? I mean, you can kind of see a hair if you look hard. Today, the minimum feature size is more than 1,000 times smaller than that. That gets incredibly tiny. But I should just say a little bit about the basic idea of how the chip works. So they had to figure out how to make the components just out of silicon. But then they also needed manufacturing processes to do two things. So one of them is to take the solid piece of silicon and etch away or insulate the parts that they don't need, to leave behind the shape of the components that are going to be used in the circuit. And the other thing is to figure out a way to get the connectors in there, because you don't just need to have a block with some capacitors, transistors, and resistors on it. You also need electrical connections between them to build the circuit. And they came up with very complex photographic processes. So they'd take that literally drawn outline on a piece of paper of the circuit that they want, and chemical processes using light-sensitive chemicals would shine light through a mask onto the surface of the chip. And light-sensitive chemicals would change their consistency where the light hit them. So where you'd blocked out the lines for where the components and the connections need to go, no light hits it. And then a series of chemical washes, bakes, and other processes would finish up leaving metal from a layer of metal on the places where you need the metal connectors, and silicon from the layer of silicon would be left behind only in the places where you want the components. And you have a miniaturized circuit on a little block of silicon that can then be packaged up, right? Because, you know, a tiny little sliver of silicon the size of your fingernail is not in itself very useful. So it has to be mounted in a package that can then be fixed into a circuit board.
And when do people start calling them chips?
That's always a colloquial name for them. The official term is integrated circuit, or IC. Silicon chip, it's literally because it's a chip off a larger wafer. So the manufacturing process they have for this is they need highly purified silicon ingot. And that's a kind of sausage-like cylinder. Then they chop that into very, very thin slices called wafers, and then be multiple chips on one wafer. So the wafers are standard sizes because they have to build very complex custom machinery for all these processes. And chips come in different sizes. So a big chip, you're going to squeeze fewer of them onto a wafer than if it's a little chip. Then the wafers go through, in modern process, apparently up to 1,000 different processes over weeks to deposit all these different layers of different materials that are needed on them to build up the complex chips. So it's a chip because the wafer, once it's gone through all these processes, is sliced up to make the individual chips, right? So it's a chip in that it's a piece of a larger wafer.
I understand that. And as this technology got smaller and more effective, was this still something that was being led from the United States?
Yeah, so we should talk about the applications here, what's actually driving this. So it said radios and hearing aids were the big applications for separately packaged transistors. And they work perfectly well for that. So the initial runs of silicon chips were much more expensive than building conventional circuits. And there were two big applications that really got the industry going. One of them was the Minuteman II nuclear missile program. So a nuclear missile is guided by a computer that's inside it, flying the thing, shoots up through space, re-enters the atmosphere, needs to come down very precisely and nuke someone. The size of the missile was actually being determined more by how small they can make the computer than how small they could make the warhead. Soviet ICBMs were actually a lot bigger because they weren't as good at miniaturizing the guidance computers. So first applications were the Minuteman guidance system and the Apollo landing computer for the lunar module that landed on the moon. And those were both places where size and weight were absolutely critical, and they needed something that was very small, rugged, and reliable. That provided an initial impetus that let companies deploy this technology commercially, begin to get experienced with it, and that greatly dropped down the price of chips to the point where they started to become viable for civilian applications.
And was this technological advance sort of across a broad front, or can we point to sort of individual chip geniuses, if you like?
Well, there's certainly some famous people who were involved in the very early days of chips. The vital early innovations were made by teams led by Jack Kilby at Texas Instruments. Texas Instruments became an important producer of chips, and listeners may be familiar with their calculators or the speak and spell machines from the 70s, say. And even more successfully, Robert Noyce, who became a founder of Intel. And Intel is, of course, the leading producer still of microprocessors for personal computers. We still didn't actually get to chips in computers, other than the Apollo guidance computer. But the gist is, I'm sure that you've heard of Moore's Law, named after one of the other founders of Intel. Moore came up with the observation that because of the constant improvements in the process technologies that were used in building chips, the number of components that you could economically squeeze onto a single chip was doubling at a fairly fixed rate. I think early on it was something like a year, then it was 18 months, then it was 2 years. It's fallen a little bit off that relationship recently, but for a remarkably long time, there was a consistent doubling period. And the thing with doubling is that gets big very fast, right? Exponential growth. So early on, you're say going from 8 to 16, but you know, then later on you're going from 500 million to a billion or something. So the absolute speed of advance keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger if you can continue to double in that way. And that took ever larger investments in researching and deploying new technologies, right? All kinds of advances in chemistry, in lasers, in optics. I think because it had been packaged in that way, people thought of it almost as a natural process that just took place by itself. It hid some of the work needed with the investments of vast sums of money. So in terms of what the chips are actually used for, the first things that chips were used for in computers was memory. So, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the idea of computer memory. What was your first computer?
I'm trying to think. I mean, I remember when they built those Sinclair calculators, you know, with Polish notation. I suppose that was probably the first thing.
Yeah. So the Sinclair computers that came along a little bit later, for example, the ZX81 had 1 kilobyte of memory. That was the smallest possible memory to be vaguely useful.
But then a lot of journalists got Tandys. That was very fashionable.
Yeah. So the computers in that kind of era would have maybe between 1 kilobyte of memory and 32 kilobytes of memory. So they they could store essentially thousands of numbers, and those numbers could represent not just numbers, but also program instructions. So you loaded the programs into memory, and they could also represent data like text or graphics. So computers have always needed to have memory, and the more memory they have in them to load programs and data into, the more complicated the jobs that they can run. Intel got its start producing memory chips in the early 1970s, and people switched from the previous technology that had been used for memories, which actually were tiny little hand-woven lattices with little magnetic donuts in. They were being hand-woven by women in India, and that was the previous memory technology, and obviously inherently expensive because it's complicated to produce. With the RAM chips, once you've got all those processes in place, you can just stamp them out on an assembly line using these photographic processes. So chips take over first for memory, and then they have the idea. You also needed a cabinet, or at least a circuit board, full of logic to control the computer and do the arithmetic operations and so on. And that was called the Central Processing Unit, or CPU. In many ways, a breakthrough that begins to transform the computer industry from the mid-1970s is the microprocessor. So Intel today is known for microprocessors. And the idea there is you put the entire core of the computer onto one chip. So instead of being a whole cabinet, or at least an entire circuit board, the core of the computer is one chip.
And would it be fair to say that this is what built Silicon Valley? This is what made the internet possible and the big titans that we now know?
It's not so much that the chip makes things possible as it makes them cheap and small. One of the results of microprocessors and memory chips becoming mainstream in the late 1970s is personal computers. But it's also things like that speak and spell machine or cheap digital weighing scales.
Mobile phones.
Yeah. So this entire category of all the devices that we use, not just the things we think of as computers, but CD players, DVD players, digital cameras, they're all basically computers in different boxes, but they're all little miniaturized computers running special purpose software. I mean, if you buy one of those annoying greeting cards that plays a little bit of music to you when you open it, that's a computer too. And it's a computer that's cheap enough that it's going to be thrown in the bin after someone's listened to it.
And what about the competition to United States-based technology? I mean, by now, obviously people, when they think of innovation in computer science, they think of China as well.
Yeah, so to give you a very short version of that, I mean, you're quite right to point to Silicon Valley, right? Nobody makes silicon chips in Silicon Valley anymore, but they used to, right? It wasn't called Computer Valley, it wasn't called Biotech Valley, it was called Silicon Valley, and it was the center of the, not just the companies that made chips, but the companies that made the specialized chemicals, the specialized photographic equipment, a whole network of different companies focused on different parts of this incredibly complicated process, made this entire ecosystem that dominated chip production in the 1970s. Moving into the 80s, the first big challenge comes from the Japanese. They invest in a big way in chip production and succeed in pretty much dominating the market for memory chips. But Intel manages to stay ahead in terms of processors, which are much more complicated custom designs with intellectual property protections. And generally, Intel managed to stay ahead in terms of the process technology because microprocessors were the most expensive, most complicated chips. Production of cheaper chips moved outside Japan to cheaper Asian locations like Korea, Malaysia, and with the general shifting of production to China, a significant microchip production in China, but not the most complicated high-end models. Now, just in the last 5-10 years, an interesting thing has happened, which is that Intel has lost its technological lead. So the most advanced chips now are made with a process technology known as extreme ultraviolet. Right? Remember, we talked about how much smaller the components on the chips have been getting. So they've got so small that regular light, visible light of any kind, just doesn't work anymore. So you may know that if you want to look at something really small, you can't use an optical microscope, you need an electron microscope. Because the thing you're looking at is so small that it's smaller than the wavelength of the light that our eyes can see. And therefore, it's impossible to take a picture of it using light. And the same thing works in reverse with this process of bombarding the light-sensitive chemicals. So they've moved now completely out of the visible spectrum of light through all kinds of exotic laser technologies. And they've finished up with extreme ultraviolet technology. And there's only one company in the world that can make the machinery that's needed to set up a factory or fab, as they're called, that uses that technology. It's actually a Dutch company. So this is where Europe makes a resurgence after having not particularly covered itself in chip-producing glory. I do believe that at the moment there are only two companies in the world that have got this technology up and running using these machines produced by the Dutch company, Samsung and TSMC, which is in Taiwan. The only plants that can produce the most advanced chips that are the core of current generation cell phones that integrate a spectacularly large number of components onto individual custom chips so that the entire core of the cell phone is just one custom chip. And they're in Korea and Taiwan, right? Both countries that have got certain geopolitical issues. So that certainly is making everybody question the systems of globalization that have led to extreme concentration of the production of these extremely vital things. And with the aid of large US government funding, Intel itself is currently ramping up a big plant in Oregon to use this new technology on a large scale. I think what we see now with the massive investments of technology needed to hit the new generation is each generation of chips that gets smaller has needed ever bigger investments and ever more ingenuity in terms of all the little individual innovations that go into figuring out how to get the entire process, you know, scaled down one more notch to make even tinier things. And I just have a quote from Wired magazine that I'd like to read to convey the scale of this. So talking about the Dutch machines that are needed for the extreme ultraviolet manufacturing process, each one is roughly the size of a bus and costs $150 million. It contains 100,000 parts and 2 kilometers of cabling. Shipping the components requires 40 freight containers, 3 cargo planes, and 20 trucks.
So that's for one tiny chip, you need an awful lot of backup.
Well, once you've got that machine there, hopefully you're going to make millions of tiny chips with it. But, you know, the real marvel, you know, is not the chip itself, but it's the machinery and the processes that make it.
And you're a historian, and I know historians hate being asked this, but where do you see the chip going now? I mean, people like me talk about quantum computing, cloud computing, all sorts of things like that, not really knowing what they are. What's the role of the chip going forward?
Well, I mean, cloud computing is just a shift in where the computing power is located. So if you grew up with Sinclair machines and Tandys and those other things, you used the idea of a completely self-contained computer. I mean, maybe you'd use the modem to file your story, but it was a self-contained box. With cloud computing, that shifts towards these gigantic centralized data centers. They're very physical, but you don't know where they are. So they seem like an intangible cloud, even though they're burning up vast amounts of electrical power, you know, in some obscure corner of the world. But that's all based on the conventional chip technology. Quantum computing is the idea that there could be a completely different underlying physical mechanism for computation. And it holds great potential in terms of some things like code breaking. So the NSA is all over it. But I would be very surprised if quantum computing becomes a mainstream thing during our lifetimes, in as much as you or I would ever own a quantum computer. So chips are definitely going to be with us for a while, but there has been a change. So in terms of personal computers, you used to hear a lot about the speed of the processor. And about 10, 15 years ago, that started to be de-emphasized because they reached limits in terms of how much faster they could continue to ramp up the speed that the chips ran at, because the issue of heat became a big thing. Now, if you want to run a chip fast, you need elaborate liquid cooling systems with it. So the whole shift has been away from having computers built around one chip that runs very fast and around systems that squeeze lots of basically individual computer processor units onto a single chip and break up the job into small pieces. So the trend has been, I think, towards optimizing power consumption rather than just optimizing raw performance at all costs. Because if you've got a cell phone, you know, you don't care how powerful it is if it's going to burn through the battery in half an hour. So what you want is the most powerful system that is able to last a full day on a charge and still go in a package that will fit comfortably in your pocket.
That was Professor Thomas Haig talking about the history of the chip in computer technology. Now, chips are, of course, very much a competitive business, and the manufacture of them is fascinating. But what about the way we use them and the race to gain dominance in the field? According to Chris Miller, the author of Chip War, the West dominance in this area is now under threat, particularly from China. And I began by asking him about his belief that chips could be at the center of the next global conflict.
Well, I think we're already in the middle of a global competition around the computer chip. And this competition is not only about economics or technology, it's also about military power. If you look at how defense strategists in the Pentagon or in China think about the future of warfare, they're investing very heavily in defense technologies that are critically reliant on semiconductors. And if you envision what it takes to maneuver an advanced drone through a battlefield, it requires immense processing power to understand the world around it, memory power to operate the software on which it runs, and then lots of signals processing from radar to infrared to audio and visual. And all of that requires specialized advanced semiconductors to operate. So there's a real sense in which access to and control over the most advanced chips isn't simply a question of your iPhone, it's a question of the future of military power.
And what is the balance of power in terms of that access at the moment?
Well, historically, the United States and its allies have dominated the design and production of advanced chips, but that's begun to change for two reasons. First is that the actual manufacture of advanced computer chips has shifted to East Asia. And today, the entire world is surprisingly, even shockingly reliant on the production of processor chips in Taiwan and memory chips in Korea. 90% of the most advanced processor chips can only be made in Taiwan, and Korea produces around 45% of the world's memory chips. So both Taiwan and Korea are critically important, not only to the chip industry, but to all of the tech sectors and every sector of the economy that relies on chips, and that's basically all of the economy today. In addition to that, the shift of manufacturing towards these geopolitical hotspots in East Asia is the fact that China, which for a long time has been completely dependent on importing chips, is trying to catch up to the cutting edge. Now, today, China still spends as much money importing chips as it does importing oil, and it's critically reliant on chips made in Taiwan, South Korea, or the United States, but it's pouring tens of billions of dollars a year into trying to catch up using all of the industrial policy tools at the Communist Party's disposal to do so. And there's more chance than ever before that in a decade's time, China will have caught up or at least made substantial progress, thereby reducing the technological gap between the Chinese military and the U.S. military, and thereby shifting the balance of military power in Asia.
I mean, I believe a lot of this is to do with technological advantage, the use of extreme ultraviolet technology. But how much of it is actually to do with access to the resources that are required for the manufacture of sophisticated chips?
Resources are not unimportant, but they're the least complicated step in the chip-making process. And even when it comes to the resources, the gases, the chemicals, the silicon and the wafers, the challenge in most cases is not actually acquiring the materials in question, but purifying them to the level of purity required in chip making. But the key choke points are not that. It's the design, it's the software, and above all, it's the machine tools needed to produce advanced chips. And fabricating the most advanced semiconductors requires acquiring machine tools from five companies in particular, which control the lion's share of the machine tool industry. Three of them are based in the US, one in the Netherlands, one in Japan. And these tools make possible the fabrication of tiny circuits, each one smaller than the size of a coronavirus, by the billions on the chips that power iPhones or artificial intelligence applications and data centers. And so these machine tools hold the key to the production of advanced chips, which is why the US and its allies are trying desperately to retain their advantage in the production of these machine tools. And China's pouring billions of dollars into trying to catch up.
So if it's Taiwan and Korea at the moment, I mean, it's not just China which is trying to catch up. But in terms of bringing home manufacturing, is that something the US is interested in as well?
The U.S. is interested in bringing home the fabrication of chips to some extent, and the Chips and Science Act that was just passed by Congress is going to devote $39 billion to that goal. It will provide funds for a number of companies to construct new facilities for fabricating leading-edge chips in the U.S. And the U.S. isn't alone in this. Japan, Singapore, the EU, a number of major players are putting funds towards subsidizing the production of advanced fabrication facilities in their countries. But the reality is that even when you consider the net effect of all of these different countries' semiconductor programs, in a decade's time, we're likely still to be quite reliant on Taiwan and Korea for the actual manufacture of the chips we depend on.
And just going to ask you a local thing to the United Kingdom, where does this leave the argument over Newport Wafer Fab? Is that something that's important or not, do you think?
Well, it is. The specific capabilities in the Newport Wafer Fab are very relevant for a subset of chips called power chips, which manage power supply, above all in electric vehicles. And so this is a subset of the industry that has very different science behind it and very different businesses that take part in comparison to, for example, the chips that power your iPhone or power your PC. But it's also an industry that's growing quite rapidly as electric vehicles spread globally. And so this is a place where the UK does have a real competitive advantage, where there's a whole lot of expertise around the cluster in Wales where the Newport Wafer Fab is located. And it's why there's been such controversy, because although the facility in question is not large, it's certainly not as impactful as the big Taiwanese or Korean firms that dominate the industry. For this particular subset, which is going to grow a lot over the coming couple of decades, the UK does have an important role to play.
And that is not related to the most high-tech chips you were talking about, the TSMC ones in Taiwan.
That's correct. It's not related to those chips, but I wouldn't describe the chips that can be made in Newport Wafer Fab as low-tech. They're just different tech, but they're no less important as we think about the semiconductor industry over the next couple of decades.
No, I'm interested in that because there's been actually some commentary saying, well, it doesn't really matter because it's old tech, but that's a wrong way of seeing it.
I think that's right. It's true that what's called the process technology, which is the size of transistors you can produce, is less advanced than in Taiwan. And in semiconductors, the smaller the transistor, the more of them you can pack on an integrated circuit, the more computing power it provides. And that's one metric of advancement. But there's also a lot of work being done right now, including in Newport, on the materials on which chips are made out of. So in a processor chip in your phone or PC, that chip is made out of silicon. But for the types of power semiconductors that you'll find, for example, managing the power supply in an electric vehicle, those are not silicon chips. There are other materials like silicon carbide that are more effective for those purposes. And there, the material science around the non-silicon materials in question is actually a key part of the measure of technological advancement. So you can't measure these chips simply by comparing the size of their transistors to the size of transistors that are produced in Taiwan, for example.
And the British government have called in the decision of the future of Newport Fab because they're worried about ultimate Chinese ownership. Should they be?
Well, I think they should be. It's clear that the Chinese buyers of Newport Wafer Fab are not operating solely on behalf of business interests or private sector interests. The Chinese government has a pretty direct line of influence over all of the country's major semiconductor investment efforts, both domestically but also internationally. A lot of the quote-unquote private equity firms in China operating in the chip space actually aren't private at all. They're owned or controlled by Chinese government institutions. And so I think we have to see any sort of Chinese investment overseas as not simply a business activity, but also as an expression of China's industrial policy goals. And I don't think anyone should be naive enough to assume that China's industrial policy goals involve prioritizing technological development in the UK.
And in terms of international relations, presumably Europeans providing advanced chip technology to China is something which the US government is very much not in favor of.
I think that's right. I mean, I would start by saying, is it something that the UK is in favor of? And I think there are serious questions to be asked about whether Chinese investment is in the best interests of the UK semiconductor sector to start with, or in the best interests of the UK auto sector, given the importance of these chips and electric vehicles. So I would start with that question rather than what the US is interested in. But
and what's the danger from that investment?
The danger is that rather than increasing investment in the UK, the expertise is acquired by the Chinese and production and eventual future R&D is transferred to China.
Because one might say, well, look, if we accept that the most advanced chip technology is in Korea and Taiwan, that a country like Wales with Newport are doing pretty well and the Chinese are importers, why should we care? I mean, that's good, isn't it? That's the West.
I think if the Chinese are importing UK chips, that's a good outcome. The worry is that if the Chinese purchase the facility in 10 years' time, they'll be producing the chips domestically and Newport will be exporting nothing to the Chinese. And if you look at the past decade of Chinese industrial policy and Chinese acquisitions of foreign chip firms, that's the trend that we've seen: more import of technology to China and less export of products from the West to China. That's explicitly the goal. The Chinese industrial policy goal is explicitly to reduce reliance on imports, which means that if you're a UK company or a UK worker, China's goal is to cut you out of their system. Now, they need your technology today to get there, but the more access they have to the underlying technology, the less likely it is that you'll be exporting to them in 10 years' time.
And do you think that the desire or Chinese ambitions in this area are one of the reasons why certainly the rhetoric is increasing with the view of one China policy towards Taiwan?
Well, there is a deep and complex interrelationship between China's pressure on Taiwan and Taiwan's role in the chip industry. So to put some numbers on the table, today, 42% of Taiwan's exports overall are semiconductors. And TSMC, the largest of these firms, makes up the lion's share of those exports. So you can't understand Taiwan's economy without placing chips at the center. And most of the chips that Taiwan exports go to China, which uses these chips to assemble iPhones and servers and PCs and all the other devices that we depend on. TSMC, the leading Taiwanese firm, is a Taiwanese company, but it's reliant on U.S. technology to produce the chips that it makes, software and also the machine tools that I was mentioning earlier. And so it imposes U.S. export control law, which means that over the past couple of years, it's cut off Chinese firms that the U.S. has demanded it stop doing business with. Huawei, for example, in 2020, used to be TSMC's second largest customer, and now TSMC doesn't produce for Huawei. And the export controls that the U.S. imposed in October, which have a sweeping impact on the ability of Chinese firms to acquire chips useful for data centers and AI, and also to have them manufactured in Taiwan, will further impact the relationship between Chinese companies and TSMC. So China's aware that, like the rest of the world, it's deeply reliant on TSMC to produce its most advanced chips. But unlike the U.S., China has no means of influencing TSMC's policies in a regulatory fashion like the U.S. can do. So I think you're right to suggest that part of the intensification of the relationship between China and Taiwan in recent years is related to this technological dependency that China has. And it's no surprise as a result that we've seen over the past couple of months a number of analysts tied to the Chinese government openly suggest that China should use military pressure and potentially even seize Taiwan as a means of gaining access to its chip-making technology.
Although from what you're saying, were China to do that and to seize Taiwan, the US could cut off its cooperation with TSMC, so it wouldn't be such a prize for the Chinese after all.
I think that's right. Analytically, it's correct to say that if China tried to take Taiwan in order to seize the semiconductor manufacturing facilities, China wouldn't succeed. The facilities in question would be damaged in any war, and even if they weren't damaged, they can't operate without equipment and software imported from the US and Japan. But I'm not sure the extent to which Xi Jinping is aware of the complexities of the semiconductor supply chain. And just this year, we've seen an example of bets on economic interdependence guaranteeing peace, like Germany's bet on relying on Russia for its gas supply, going horribly wrong. And so I think anyone who thinks that mutually assured economic destruction is going to provide for peace in the Taiwan Straits is, I'm afraid, overconfident, because the past couple of years have shown, A, in Europe, an example of how that can go very badly, and B, in China, a government that's increasingly less focused on GDP growth or economic outcomes and more focused on its geopolitical goals and its posture on the world stage. And that's the type of government that might be willing to roll the dice on a Taiwan attack or a Taiwan pressure campaign, betting that it's better able to withstand the economic costs of such a conflict than Taiwan or the West.
And is it? Because it seems to me what you are envisaging is two technologically competing blocks, if you like, broadly speaking, around the West and around China. I mean, is that what you foresee?
At the cutting edge, I think that's where we're already headed. Today, I think when it comes to non-cutting edge chips, there still is a fair amount of interaction between Chinese firms and non-Chinese firms, and U.S. government regulations are explicitly designed to let that continue, to continue allowing U.S. and foreign firms to trade and invest and interact with Chinese chip firms that are not at the cutting edge. But the U.S. is committed to retaining control for it and its allies of the most cutting edge chips. And the recognition that drives this is not simply that they're important for economic reasons or for smartphones or for data centers or for big tech firms, but for military systems. This is ultimately a question of who controls the computing power that will define the future of military systems.
And which side do you think is better placed?
Well, I think any assessment of the situation would conclude that the Western side is better placed. It has a technological advantage today. It has a larger share of the global economy and the global technological investment infrastructure on its side. But I don't think that should be an argument for complacency, because the reality is that the Western position has deteriorated dramatically over the past couple of years. And in particular, when you look at the military balance, especially in the Taiwan Straits, you've got to recognize that it's not simply enough for the US and the West in general to stay slightly ahead technologically. And the reason is that we already are falling behind, and we will fall far more behind to the Chinese in terms of the number of military systems deployed. Ship by ship, tank by tank, we're going to be outproduced by the Chinese, and we already are. So we've got to retain not only an advantage, but a substantial advantage in technological terms over the Chinese in order to retain our military advantage. And that's why this chip question is so important, because computing power is the foundation behind most of our technological advantages. And if we're going to slow the erosion of our military position in Asia, which has eroded dramatically over the past couple of years, it's going to depend on shoring up this advantage in computing power. Otherwise, we're simply in a competition of who can produce the most ships or the most missiles and most airplanes, and that's a competition we're most likely to lose.
And how likely do you think it is that this is going to come to conflict?
Well, I certainly hope it doesn't, and I think that open conflict is still not the most likely outcome. But the reality is we've got to prepare for the situation as it stands, and that situation includes the prospect that some sort of conflict is a lot more plausible now than it was 5 years ago.
Chris Miller there on the possible chip wars of the future. My thanks to him and to Professor Thomas Haig. This episode of Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas was funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer is Murray Jessel, the assistant producer Eve Webster, the sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Until the next time, thanks for listening.